Forging Ahead. It's not the normal intro music. This is the Hold Steady, and the tune is Swish. And today's program, I'll be talking with Franz Nicolay, formerly of the Hold Steady, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Humorless Ladies of Border Control, which is touring the punk underground from Belgrade to Ulaanbaatar. And that's out now by the New Press. When Franz left the Hold Steady, he went on a tour of the Eastern Bloc and took the Trans-Siberian Railroad. He's a tremendous intellect, a fantastic musician, and it was a thrill to talk with him and to record this interview. We are going to start out with a discussion of punk rock. We're going to talk politics. We're going to talk touring life. And in the second half of the show, we're going to hear some of his music from an album entitled Do the Struggle, which is a story in and of itself. So without further ado, here we go with Franz Nicolay. This is a marvelous travelogue of your tours over several years in Eastern Europe.
The former communist world.
The former communist world, right.
Yeah. And in the case of China, the currently communist world, nominally communist world.
But you skipped China in this book.
We removed that chapter just to keep it as part of, to keep the Slavicness of it a little more of a... of a through line.
And you're a self-described Slavophile.
Indeed.
Yeah. How did you become a Slavophile?
Well, in the usual way, I think.
I have no idea.
For a lot of people, a lot of Americans anyway, I got really into Russian literature when I was a teenager.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you fell in love with Russian literature. What about it? You must have been a sort of quiet, somewhat introverted...
bookish, I think, is the word that people use. You know, there's a lot about the entry level Russian literature that appeals to a teenager.
What is the gateway Russian literature, or what was it for you? What got you sort of?
I think Crime and Punishment.
That's gateway.
Lermontov. Hero of our time.
Mm-hmm. But what do you think, as a young man, appealed to you about the scope, the otherness?
It's the same sort of thing that makes, you know, teenage boys attracted to Camus. You know, it's that sort of like introduction to existentialism and you know, indulging in your darker suspicions about yourself and the world.
Mm. You have a real interesting line in the book, or a section in the book about how Russia somehow appropriates ideas from the West.
There's a couple through. One of the things in the book is I wanted it not to just be a travelogue in terms of my, you know, describing my own travels, but in terms of engaging and being in conversation with other writers who had written about the same. The same journeys, of which there are plenty, especially along the Trans-Siberian Railroad, you know, going back to Chekhov, the French writer, the Marquis de Custine. Anyone who saw the film Russian Ark will be familiar with the character of Custine, who's the narrator in that film.
And could you briefly tell us a little bit about Custine?
He was a French aristocrat in the revolutionary era. He was a closeted homosexual, which was revealed at one point. So he was a famous, sort of a scandalous figure. He considered himself a man of letters, although couldn't. One of his contemporaries called him a half man of letters. Because he never quite achieved the reputation that he thought he deserved. He published a travelogue, I believe it was to Spain, that Balzac appreciated, and encouraged him to pursue that, to write about some of the more, what was then considered some of the more peripheral areas of Europe, including Russia. And he was also inspired by the example of de Tocqueville,
right?
Whose famous writings on America had been published a couple of years before. So Custine goes to Russia, goes in a monarchist and comes out a confirmed Democrat, from what he sees of the Russian political system. He has a snide point of view. He's very cutting in his remarks. One of the things that I found interesting about, you know, comparing travelogues of some of these places, you know, some from 50, some from 100, some from 200 years ago, is comparing, you know, the through lines, the things that jibed with the things that I saw, and the things that, of course, that are different. You know, you find that the similarities are in some cases more numerous than you might think.
I was really surprised, especially I'm thinking, well, maybe it's your choice of author, and Custine was one, and Rebecca West was another. for the section
on the Balkans,
that it made me think, well, maybe there is such a thing as sort of national character.
Right. This is a theory that's gone out of fashion, of course, in the modern age. But, you know, in the same way that you can read de Tocqueville and recognize something of the America that we still know, even if it's an imagined America, you know, people's conception of what their own country is or what their own national character is does have some valence in terms of affecting how they interact with each other and how they conceive of the world. And so, you know, the idea of Russian black humor is something that you find very early on, and certainly it is still extremely prevalent in the way Russians talk about their own.
You explore history, literature, and music as well. You're on the road for 5 years for this book. Is this the culmination of...
This is tours basically between 2012 and 2015.
Mm.
Yeah, 4 years of touring, you know, often going back. There's several trips to Ukraine. There's several trips to Eastern Europe. There's one long trip in Russia, but in 2012 from basically from the Ukrainian border, the area that's now a war zone,
right,
up to St. Petersburg, and then down the Trans-Siberian Railroad as far as Lake Baikal.
I mean, this is a part of the world that has pretty much dropped off the map for most Americans.
Until recently. But yes, well, I'll accept the premise for now. But yeah, continue the question.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, there was a, when I started writing the book, there was a sense that Russia was this backwater. You know, you remember that
right.
Romney got ridiculed as recently as 2012 for suggesting that Russia was our number one geopolitical enemy,
right.
And within a couple of years, that actually came to seem a little bit prescient,
right?
In the post-Sochi, post-Ukrainian invasion intervention in Syria,
And now recently with the hacking of the DNC,
They're starting to make, you know, in the last couple of days, they're starting to amp up the propaganda in Crimea and the tension in eastern Ukraine again. So I think there's very much a perception about Russia as a geopolitical threat that was not there.
Right. Yeah.
It certainly is
reemerging.
Yeah.
But from let's say 1991 and the fall of communism.
Sure.
And now with sort of the reemergence of Russia, all these new nations were born.
Mm.
All these new reborn,
I think they would say.
Reborn, yeah.
Reemerged.
And I like your choice of West as another companion writer who was writing during the 30s, the interwar years, because a lot of these countries really almost only existed at that time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in that... So an interesting parallel in those times, right? Because that's that's a situation where all these nations or nation states emerged from the collapse of another multi-ethnic empire, the Habsburg Empire,
right,
at that
right.
point, with also with you know, with often very violent results. And so what I like, what I'm interested in about West is this idea that she, as an English woman, as a privileged English woman in the wake of the First World War, which was touched off by an incident in what was definitely considered a backwater.
Sure, sure.
And she's trying to answer the question for herself. What just happened, and why were all these millions of deaths touched off by this event in Serbia, a place that I know nothing about? And she goes to Serbia and wants to really get to the bottom of that history. You know, of course, she's going there during a time when fascism is ramping up, both in Italy and in Germany, and so it's both an exploration of the history of the Balkans and why it became such a flashpoint, but also a look ahead to what was brewing. And she's very, very sharp on both of those points.
Yeah, her writing is very sharp, and so is Christine. But she is a much more modern sensibility.
Yeah, and a much deeper intellect. You know,
you think?
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that she says in the conclusion to her book is that, you know, she doesn't know where. Again, she's writing in the 30s. She can tell that something is coming. She doesn't know how it's going to play out. She doesn't know how the people that she's talking to or whose words she's transcribing are going to make it through whatever it is that's coming. Most of them don't. But she says, imagine that there was a woman in Rome in the 400s writing about the feeling of impending doom or impending collapse, what the everyday experience in Rome before its fall felt like. That we would consider that a really valuable document, and that she hoped that at the very least that her book could be a document like that. And that was sort of how I began to conceptualize parts of this book, especially some of the parts that take place in Russia and Ukraine. Not that I'm claiming that the people that I'm talking to, especially the young people, are necessarily going to be the people who take part in you know, their political futures of their country, although some of them will. But that it's important to capture how people react on the ground in these moments. And you know, like one of the kids says, it's like I'm reading a book of history and I don't know how it ends.
And again, one of the wonderful things about reading your book is the way you are. There's very little buffer between you and just the bottom rung of or youth culture. I mean, really, you're getting a look into these countries and these regions and the people that an aimless tourist would just not be able to get.
You know, it's an excuse for journalism. Let's put it that way. You know, when I started touring by myself or with my wife, instead of touring with groups, you know, you become a lot more mobile and a lot, you know, quicker on your feet. You can go to places. You can use touring as an excuse to go to places that you're interested in going.
Sure.
You can travel without a lot of the infrastructure that comes with touring with bands.
And did you manage to like actually sustain yourself with the money you made on the road?
Oh yeah.
And
well, so this is another thing, is that you can justify a lot of these trips in a way that you couldn't if you were just taking them as vacation or as travel or as, you know, for whatever reason that you might want to go to a place. You can set an itinerary, and then you can make a little money. You know, some of the places you can make more money than others, but what I started to do was book, like, for example, a European tour such that I would go to to Germany for a week where I knew that I could make money and use that to subsidize, for example, going to Serbia where the currency is weak. And
I thought it was interesting that Poland actually was your cash cow for some of these.
Well, Poland is quite a thriving country at this point. Yeah, a lot of several of the people that I talk to in Eastern Europe point to Poland and say, you know, they really played the game right in terms of playing, you know, playing European subsidies and German guilt and all these other things to their economic advantage. Yeah, Poland is a country that a lot of Eastern Europe looks to as a success story. And when I first started going to Europe for touring, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you would hear these like ghost stories about like, oh, you know, punk shows in Poland. It's, you know, there's all these, you know, zombified drunk Polish punks. Now it's no different than doing a Western European show.
A little sad.
There are other places you can go for that experience.
You're listening to Foraging Ahead and my interview with Franz Nicolai, whose book, The Humorless Ladies of Border Control, Touring the Punk Underground from Belgrade to Ulaanbaatar, is out. Franz is a professional musician, and he has stories to tell. Punk. Right. I listen to your music, and I guess is that punk music? I mean,
punk
it
is
seems
a state of
it
mind,
seems
not
it
a
seems.
Genre.
All right,
I still stand by that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because I was like, this is way too crafted and melodic, and well written to be punk music.
Right. Well, in a lot of ways, genre is a function of who your friends are, and more than it is the kind of music you make after a certain point. You know, I'm not one of these kids who... I grew up in rural New Hampshire. We didn't have punk, a punk scene. I wasn't coming from, you know, suburban New Jersey or Southern California or some of, the, you know, Washington, D.C. or some of these places. So I came to it late. But, of course, as they say in religion, late converts are always the
most fanatical.
The most fanatical. Yeah. And I did find in it a congenial community in terms of the intelligence the questioning nature of it and the family sensibility. You know, of course it has its frustrating downsides as well. But the result of that has been, you know, since that's the scene in which I made my sort of musical bones, that remains, you know, those are just the people, you know,
right.
You know, and so you end up on bills with people, you know. I have been many times the only banjo player on a hardcore bill, but that's just because those are the people who know who I am and will put on a show for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm always resistant to the idea that punk means something very specific musically in terms of, like, you know, a 4 or 5 piece loud guitar band with X, Y, or Z. I think that's something that became an aspect of marketing after the commercial breakthrough of a lot of this stuff in the 90s that pop punk specifically came to stand in for punk at large. But, you know, if you look at you know, American and British bands of the late 70s and 80s, there's a huge variety of musical sensibilities. It speaks to a stance and a sensibility more than it does to a technical choice of instruments or how to perform.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly the communities, what was interesting about your touring is that you always landed in a community.
This is one of the things that I've always appreciated about the punk community, and one of the things that makes it possible to do these global touring opportunities is because there's this sense of there's an archipelago, you know, to borrow a phrase, of young people with progressive political ideals, internet enabled, with a shared sensibility about community, about communitarianism, about creating a space for themselves, and you know, like any community of shared ideals, whether it's a religious community or a, you know, a societal community, you can go anywhere in the world and plug into that community.
Yeah.
You know, and the internet has made it that much easier. I mean, a lot of these places where I didn't have someone booking the tours, it was just a matter of my picking some cities, likely looking cities off the map, Googling, you know, that city's name plus punk or plus DIY.
Right.
Some sort of blog comes up, you email them out of the blue. They say, oh, yeah, I'm not booking shows anymore, but here's two other names of people in different cities. They're going to do it for you. Or like, oh, he only does hardcore, but so-and-so will do an acoustic show, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it's just that easy.
Yeah, it is. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you have the goods.
If you have the goods, but I mean, you know, there's a lot of people out there who don't have the goods. And they, you know, if you don't ask for money up front, there are a lot of people who will just throw you on a bill.
And would you ask for money up front or no?
I usually do.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because I have the goods and I have the CV. Well,
yeah.
Certainly. I mean, I do have a little bit of an advantage where in that initial email I can name drop some bands that I've played with that people have heard of.
Right.
And so that helps open the door.
Mm. So would you mind reading a section you got here on punk? I really liked that. Pretty much sums up.
Sure. So this is from the conclusion.
Yeah.
Of the book. Punk is largely a bourgeois phenomenon. Some base level security is a prerequisite for rebellion based on ideals. Mostly staffed by students or people with mid-level creative industry jobs with decent English and internet access. And there tend to be three kinds of punk politics: the no borders, no war pacifists, the revolution porn radicals, and the generic center-left liberals, none of whom, for the most part, will be personally involved in the fighting, and all of whom want or assume, like most middle-class kids, the privileges of Western liberal society. But those sorts of assumptions have a kind of power, too, in that they breed a powerful resentment when unfulfilled. And punk and DIY on the American model constitute training wheels for the kind of self-organizing civil society pundits long for in developing countries, taking the unused semi-public space the former communist world is lousy with and commandeering it for the common good. Or if not good, at least enjoyment. Or if not enjoyment, at least the feeling of doing something in common, with the idea that it might push the ball an inch toward a better society.
...of your experience, because you get that, and you get it eventually, you know, over the course of time. I mean, you got ripped off so few times, it was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, according to what you wrote, anyway, I'm sure there was a lot. I mean, the one time you got robbed was in France.
In France, yeah.
You know, and then you didn't even. And one time you almost got stiffed was in Romania.
Yeah, I mean, you get stiffed from time to time.
Right.
I got stiffed in Russia and in. Yeah, I mean, in Bulgaria, it was more a guy trying to be sketchy with me.
Right, right.
But in the end, I got his partner to pay me back.
But
for the most part, people are pretty straightforward. We're not talking about huge sums of money. You know,
right.
the places, the situations in which people get ripped off is when you're playing, you know, when you're talking about these are small shows.
Yeah.
You know, I remember hearing a story about a hardcore band, a famous New York hardcore band I know that went down to play a huge festival in Brazil, you know, 100,000 people.
Right.
Then you're talking about real money. They went to get paid. The promoter literally, like, pushed the cash to them across the table, put a gun on top of it, pulled it back to himself as if to say, got a problem with that? Like, this is how it's going to be. So nothing like that because, you know, we're talking about 100 euros here and there for me.
Right, right. But still to get you from one community to the next.
Well, this is it goes back to your question about can you make money doing that? And it's the answer is, you know, if you're playing small shows, you just travel even lighter. You know,
right.
if I'm traveling by myself with a rental car, it's, you know, let's say 15 euros a day, 20 euros a day for a rental car, another 20 euros a day for food. And if I can make 100 on the show, that's a good profit.
Mm-hmm.
And that adds up if you do it for 6 or 7 weeks.
It seems like Russia, and this is my impression from a like being there and hearing what you said and talking with people, that Russia just doesn't have that. That they've been trained, not just through communists, but like generations. And this is horrible stereotype generalization. But that sort of self-organizing principle that we found in all of these different cities that you traveled in, was it absent, or what was the difference?
Well, there's a learned helplessness, I think. There's a cynical nihilism, apolitical, a turn away from politics because the political system is so corrupt, because any dissent is either manufactured behind the scenes by the government as an outlet, or quickly suppressed. You didn't find among the Russian punk scene this idea that this could be anything other than an escape for them, as opposed to the Ukrainian punks, who were really politically engaged, had been a part of the Maidan movement in various
For my American audience, the Maidan movement, could you briefly
was the popular revolution in Ukraine that drove the Russian-backed president Yanukovych out of power in the winter of 2013-2014.
Yeah. So Ukraine had two revolutions in like a decade.
Yes,
right?
Exactly, a decade apart. Which on the one hand is wow, look at that. On the other hand, if the first one worked, you don't need the second one.
Right. Or they're just really good at making revolutions.
Not quite as good at the follow through.
Well, isn't that always the case?
What did Mao say?
I'm really good. I like smashing things. I don't like the building.
I've never heard that, but it rings true. Something to that effect.
I don't know. Yeah, it was to paraphrase him.
This is always the question: the rebuilding. What comes afterwards? Do you leave the existing bureaucracy in place? Do you try to the lustration question? Do you try to remove all of the existing power structures and build it up from scratch, or do you hope that the existing bureaucracy is essentially apolitical themselves?
Right.
The problem, of course, being one of corruption, which is the major problem in reforming, the political system in Ukraine, particularly.
Yeah. You had a very good line on corruption. I don't know if it was in Ukraine or Russia where you were talking with somebody, and they said, "Don't you have corruption in the United States?" And you think the response was like, "Yeah, but it's only like higher up."
Well, this is
like it's not on a petty shakedown level.
Yeah, this is a common thing you hear, particularly from Russians, is the cynical assumption,
right,
that corruption in the public and private sphere operates the same way the world over, and that we are naive or in denial for assuming that it could be any other way. And my point there was that there's a difference between situational corruption and systemic corruption. Like, yes, there are people in the United States in politics or in law enforcement or wherever that are crooked, absolutely. But when they're exposed, there's general public condemnation
and opprobrium,
and everyone is the general assumption is that's not how it should be, and that's not how we want it to be,
right?
As opposed to an assumption that corruption exists on every level. It has always been that way, and it will always.
It's
be
just part
that
of
way.
The human condition.
That's right.
Yeah. As an American. You would, and this is always useful, you would essentially just play the Gomer. Like, if there was a shakedown situation with a...
There is an assumption that Americans are
idiots.
Dumb.
Yeah.
And you can make that work for you. Just sort of blink
you
and
tell
grin.
That story? Would you tell one of those stories? Do you have handy? I think you got pulled over by the police. I forget what country it was.
This is in Ukraine. This is Maria was driving,
right,
actually.
Right.
Or I was driving, and her Ukrainian is better than mine, so she was the one who was actually dealing with the cop. There's not an explicit quid pro quo.
Right.
It's more of a...
You get my drift.
You get my drift.
Right.
And if you don't get his drift, eventually it's just too much trouble for him to keep hinting that he's going to take you down to the police station, and you're going to be there for a couple hours. you know, it's costing him money to be sitting there with a dummy who's not just going to give him some money when he could just let you go and pull over someone else who will.
Right.
I think there is still a benefit that comes with carrying an American passport, mm-hmm. that they don't want to really get down to it.
Another point you make about sort of the punk scene or leaders in the punk scene is how they would seem ironically turn towards almost fascism or nationalism or to the right wing.
One of the threads that I sort of that emerged in the writing of this book was about the ways in which counterculture heroes of the 70s and 80s took a turn in some of these countries in their middle age and later years towards a kind of
cranky right-wing nationalism.
And the analogy I draw is, you know, I find that there's a slightly analogous trend in some aging punks towards the kind of, you know, Ron Paul kind of libertarianism,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if your whole sense of yourself has been about making your own way and fighting the system,
right.
you know, and so on. But in the confused politics of you know, the post-communist sphere, that sense of nationalism, which was a useful tool against the supranational enemy of the Soviet Union, becomes a little bit more dangerous in the post-Soviet era of militant nationalism. So you find this with people like Kusturica in Serbia,
right?
With Letov in Russia. The reason I brought in Limonov is because, just to tie it all together, was because he was a guy who was on the scene as a young writer, as an expat in New York in the 70s. And he fell in with Richard Hell and Patti Smith and the Ramones, and that was really a huge part of his formative self-conception. He grew up in Soviet Ukraine, emigrated to New York, and when he came back to Russia, when he moved to Russia in the 90s, and got into politics and sort of radical politics, his sense of himself as punk. And specifically the punk of the 70s that appropriated symbolism like swastikas and offensive language as for its shock value for its own sake, played into his political conception. Right, so he put together a party called the National Bolshevik Party.
Yeah, that was wild.
It's the flag of the party was the Nazi flag with a hammer and sickle instead of a swastika. Not because necessarily he wanted to, you know, he wasn't necessarily a fascist or a communist, but he wanted it, but for the sake of the shock value and to attract the kind of counterculture elements in Russia that appealed to his sense of himself as shocking and punk.
And that actually brings us to an interesting concept that you brought. I use the word interesting way too much. I'm going to have to cut this out of there. But it is interesting. It is just a really fascinating depth that you go to in historical research and presenting the ideas in a really fun, clear way. But the concept of, I'm going to mispronounce it, but Stjob. I love the concept of Stjob, and it's almost Kafkaesque. I mean,
it's the kind of satire that you would imagine would grow up in an authoritarian political system.
This is from the section called Tomsk to Baikal. Stjob was parody, so deadpan, so straight-faced, that it became indistinguishable from the real thing. The authorities would be aware of and reactive to traditionally or literally dissident language, but since the highly formalized language of late socialism meant that it was more important to reproduce approved phraseology than to concern oneself with the words, what the words might mean in a literal sense. Official lingo proved a useful Trojan horse in which to insert subversive meaning.
Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, if you can try to come up with analogous, again, analogous things in American life. One of the suggestions I raise in the book is to think of the Stephen Colbert character,
yeah,
not as a parody character on a left wing comedy channel, but as hired as an actual Fox News commentator. The essence of Stjob is the idea that of undermining the existing system, the existing ways of speaking, by exposing them to ridicule by using their own conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So another example I think would be, this comes up in academic journal literature every couple of years. Someone will get published an article,
mm-hmm,
in a reputable academic journal that's
nonsense,
just
and gibberish. Yeah. Well, the same with, I mean, the art world.
The
artist statements are, you know, or even descriptions of paintings or critiques are just, does that mean anything?
Right.
It's just
again, like, where the language becomes so formalized that you can use it as a parody of itself.
But then that sort of undermines all meaning in that formal language.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And does it make it inoperative?
The intent is to expose the fact that there's no inherent meaning in it.
Right.
And that in a political context also exposes the lack of a moral center to the politics. I think that's the idea.
Hmm. Do you think possibly that Donald Trump's presidential run is one elaborate exercise in Stjob?
I think it's one elaborate exercise in self-aggrandizement that got out of his hands. I mean, I think you can make some comparisons between Limonov and Trump if that's where you're going with this.
A little bit.
That
he was never a punk.
Right. Well, there's a couple things. One is that Limonov's political following in his heyday was young people.
Right.
Right. So if you can imagine a right wing nationalist Bernie Sanders or something like that, where the appeal is to the youth counterculture. And that, you know, that did raise some of the uncomfortable sort of fascistic aspects. Right. Because you get a lot of young men with shaved heads and pit bulls involved. To the extent that they both sort of glory in making provocative statements just for the sake of the provocation of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a, in there that there's a comparison in terms of some of their political tactics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Certainly violence.
Violence, what's the word I'm looking for? A fascination with militarism,
mm-hmm,
to compensate for a sense of personal inadequacy about never having been an actual tough guy themselves.
Uh-huh.
Play acting at being a tough guy. They have that in common.
Huh. Interesting.
But, Limonov fancied himself an artist and was, you know, he was a respected writer for many years until his political activity put him on the outs in the West. I don't think Trump, famously has barely read a book, has no patience for these things.
Right.
I don't think he would have any...
In that way, he speaks to a great many Americans.
Indeed. Yes.
Well, I like your concept of German splaining.
Uh-huh.
Inevitably, you said on the tour that some young German punk needs to tell you about how the American political system works.
Yes,
and why doesn't George Bush
care about this obscure backwater that's really important to me.
What is George Bush's policy on Macedonia?
On Macedonia,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Germans.
No offense to our Macedonian listeners.
The point being that George Bush probably was not aware of his policy on Macedonia.
Or the existence of a country called Macedonia.
Or the existence of the dispute about
the Greek state and the
former Yugoslav state. Yeah, I understand that that's what he was getting at, but, you know, getting in the weeds. I mean, the point being this is, you know, specific to the German punk scene is that these kids are very politically serious, very politically righteous. You know, I feel bad making fun of them because they're, you know, the point is
to be
absolutely correct.
Yeah.
You know, to be on the right side of the progressive side of all these political issues.
But I mean, isn't that almost as much a function of youth?
It's a function of youth, but it's also a function of there's still a German reaction against their history.
Yeah.
You know, wanting to they want to be on the right side of history in any way they can, even to their own detriment. So, and it's very important to them also to engage in self-critique.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the ongoing jokes for American musicians who tour in Germany is that you'll get German music fans coming up to you afterwards and saying, I am thinking that perhaps your show was not as good this time as last time, and what is the problem? You know?
Uh-huh.
And their response when I've called them out on that is they think that the American habit of complimenting any performer when they get off the stage is equally ludicrous.
Right.
Because you're not always great.
Right.
And if you're not always great, you should know you're not always great and be able to explain why you weren't as good this time or why you haven't put out as good an album as that other album. You know, have you really considered what it is that you're doing wrong?
But how are you supposed to answer that? Like, I just didn't care.
Yeah. We're just not as good anymore.
I saw you.
It's the honest truth.
I saw you were in the crowd, and I thought, I'm just not going to bother.
Well, no, it's not like that. I mean, they,
no, but how, I didn't
the idea
how
is,
they expect you to
the
answer.
Idea is to
or the self-criticize.
Self-criticism to say, you know what, I don't think, you know, our enthusiasm for the material is as strong as it once was. I think we're going to have to really reconsider, you know, whether these are still political and ethical ideas that we stand behind, you know, stuff like that. And you know, if we're not willing to live up to the, you know, what we expressed in this album from 10 years ago, maybe we should break up the band and, you know, reform under a different, you know, this is the sort of thing.
Thank you so much for pointing that out. I think I'm going to rethink my whole life now.
Well, no, that's very literally the idea.
Yeah.
No, if you're quite serious about ethics and politics in that way, ideals, you know, that you should be constantly engaged in.
Yeah, yeah. But
self-assessment.
But it's exhausting, isn't it?
It's very exhausting.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
Especially when you're on tour and you're traveling, and you like traveling. I mean,
I do like traveling.
And it's...
I like the traveling more than the arriving, to be honest. You know, I like the driving during the day much more than the arriving and doing the thing at night.
Huh.
Because the doing the thing at night is there's a core of it that's the same.
But doesn't it make almost the traveling... Like, doesn't that then give you the freedom to enjoy the traveling more rather than knowing? I mean, that's what my takeaway of this, and maybe I'm just reading more deeply than you. I'm joking.
I'm just telling tour stories, man.
No, but that the routine, and again, I
the
totally
routine is what gives you the anchor.
I totally appreciate that you just said, this is the routine. At the beginning of the book, you said, this is the routine, and I'm not going to, like, go through the routine every night.
Describe it once.
But I'll describe it once, and then I'll give you the sort of the scene around the routine, because that's what the interesting part is. But that you have that anchor every night, don't you feel like that allows you to enjoy? I mean,
absolutely, yes. Once, you know, when I first started touring by myself, there was a lot of anxiety hung up around the show itself, right? Was anybody going to come? Was I going to be able to perform up to my standards?
Right.
This and after a certain amount of time, that goes away. I'm comfortable with it. There's going to be some people there, and that I'll be able to perform. And so I can, you know, I can turn my energy and attention to these other things, to exploring the history, to exploring the towns, to talking to the people, to, you know, to thinking about the travel on its own terms, and then, and, you know, trying to describe the things as they go by, and really engage with the places I'm going, rather than being in a hurry to get to another dark bar.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Stress out about what, you know, what songs I'm going to play.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that
routine does give, you know, in situations where I'm on the road for 200, 250 days a year,
yeah.
That is the centering device, you know, in the same way that going home every night after work is when you're at home.
Right.
Arriving at the place and doing, going through these steps, loading in, setting up the merch, sound checking, writing a set list, playing the show, selling merch, packing up. You know, that's the centering device.
You're taking pleasure in taking prisoners. Is that a dull hum or a muted whisper? Just listen. It's not a problem if you miss her. Time doesn't tell, but time can take. After the war, what can remain in the ruin of faith in the refrain? I never did believe leaving get you anywhere but gone. I was wrong. Trust your gut and you hold your tongue. Did you really think we were the only ones? There's more where we came from. I hear sometimes it's time to take off. When it gets too hard or when your skin won't stay soft, a jaw feels like a loss. Never did believe leave and get you anywhere but gone. I was wrong. I was wrong. Never did believe that leave and get you anywhere but gone. I was wrong. I was wrong. Control.
Forging Ahead on WGXC 90.7, Acre of Hudson, Catskill, the station that everybody loves. And this is Forging Ahead. I'm Kevin Factor, and I am talking with Franz Nicolay, formerly of the Hold Steady, and now on his own and doing very well. That song we just heard was from his album Do the Struggle with Emmalyn Brodsky, and the title of that lovely, lovely song was Take No Prisoners. And we've got a little bit more time, and we're going to continue our fascinating conversation with Franz, just an endlessly interesting, brilliant human being. Some of the vignettes that you tell are just really just beautiful, and the way that, and maybe it's the community, maybe it's the way that people react to the music, or you know, your common interests, but you really get a sense of the individual and also of the country that you're in, like that in, I think it was Mongolia. Was it Mongolia where that the sort of guy ran after you and Maria?
And he wanted relationship advice.
He wanted relationship advice. Yeah. That was like so. That's what a beautiful like moment. I thought. Yeah.
I mean, I have a couple things to say about that. One is that I interact with people differently when I'm traveling than I do when I'm at home.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot easier for me to talk to people. We have a built-in opening to conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm there. I'm going to be performing. That's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think this is something a lot of performers share, is that it, you know, we do have a drive for connection on some level, but that it's easier to do that, and it's you're less vulnerable because you're the center of attention, right? It's really a one way conversation if you're on stage, but it's an opening to conversation afterwards, or because they know why you're there, they know who you are. You can get past the small talk. I mean, I don't think I'm as good a conversation. I mean, we live in the same town. I don't think I'm as social or as good a conversationalist.
No,
the
only reason I have you on the show is because I enjoy talking with you, and I never see you.
Right.
So this is, I get to spend an hour here and there with Franz, and that's
right. And then there's also an aspect of I'm leaving town. You know, I'm only in these places for a couple of hours.
All right. So nothing you can say is going to really damage anybody.
That's right. I don't have to live with the consequences of these conversations. I can ask them really blatant, really personal questions.
Uh-huh.
And they'll say things to me also.
Because they know you're going.
Because they know I'm leaving.
Right.
You know, it's not something. And so that's a real, you can have much franker, much more open conversations because you have these limits around your emotional responsibility to each other.
In this one little section, you're pretty brutally honest with yourself and with the reader about yourself. And brutal, but it's sort of the end of the Bulgaria section. You're leaving Bulgaria, going back to Romania.
Mm-hmm.
Romania seems to be the saddest country that you visited, apart from. I don't know. You could tell me what you felt.
I always think of a border town in Mongolia, a place called
right?
Naushka, right on the Chinese border, as being one of the most depressing places I've ever been. You know, border towns. I think I say in the book, there's an opportunity with border towns. You would think that on one level, you might want to present, you know, best face forward, especially
right.
if there's a customs station and a crossing, and this is going to be people's first experience with your. But in actual fact, usually what happens, of course, is they become these sort of emotional DMZs because no one wants to be there. Everyone's trying to cross the border as quickly as they can.
Right.
And in that particular case, it was a real wasteland. Now the Chinese on the other side of that particular border had sort of taken up that challenge, and it was a very lovely town, I must say.
Yeah.
So that's one of those, like, you know, you get these psychological experiences of crossing borders. You know, borders are, there's a, there's a, there's a, a kind of thinking that's popular, especially among the on the left, that the borders are just a state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that borders can and should be eliminated. But a border is a real thing, mm-hmm. and it's not just the political and military aspect of crossing borders that makes them a real thing. There's a psychological aspect. There's a way that, you know, there's things about architecture. There's things about the way people carry themselves. There's things about the way that, you know, the train conductors hold themselves differently and interact with you differently when you cross a border. You know, going back to, you know, to circle back around to where we started the conversation, there is a certain valence to the idea of a national character that can't be entirely dispensed with.
Human beings need boundaries, you mm-hmm. know, if only to
boundaries
to test
around
them.
And you know, expanding concentric boundaries, so, you know, boundaries around ourselves, around our family, around our town, around our nationality, around our language group.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, where do those boundaries break down?
Well,
and
that's
where do
right.
they become meaningless?
And one of the things that this sort of worldwide punk rock archipelago has in common is a kind of boundarylessness, an aspirational boundarylessness, mm-hmm. based on a set of you know, aspirational ideals about politics and ethics and communitarianism, you know, which is achieved to varying degrees.
You said you have there's a touring persona that you have.
Mm.
How does traveling like that transform or inform your sense of self, and does it wear on you? Is it? I mean, it just
sure.
I mean, for some people, it's just it strips you bare in a lot of ways, don't you think?
Right. There's a couple ways to answer that. One is what I said.
There's 20 questions in there. Right?
No, it's versions. It's circling around the same question. Which is about the psychological experience of traveling and why it appeals to some people and why other people find it, you know, repelling or uncomfortable in the extreme. There is an appeal to it for personality types like me, I think, that have a constant sort of existential itch. the idea is staying one step ahead of yourself.
Right.
And it's not a solution in the long term, but it's a temporary solution, you know, the idea of staying one step ahead of your problems, the idea that, you know, as I said about having these, you can have these very intense connections with people for one night because you're leaving. So it's a way of having that emotional connectivity without having any emotional responsibility.
Right.
It's a way of explaining away your existential unease. It's, you know, because you can attribute it to not having slept well,
right.
or having had a long drive, or not being able to find a good dinner, or all these things that you can use to explain away why you're a little.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're comfortable at home with your family in your house and you still feel a little cranky, then you actually have to reckon with.
maybe I'm just a prick.
Maybe I'm just, for example, maybe I'm the problem. You know, there is a common denominator here.
Constant, have you had okay, you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acre. This is Kevin Factor. That was Foraging Ahead. Up next is Effie with In the Cut. Take cover.